Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
5 young students disappear from Washington, D.C. They leave behind a disturbing farewell video, and they show up in Pakistan, allegedly ready to fight a holy war.
They fell under the spell of radical Islam, either online or through radical imams in their local mosque.
Are American families second-guessing themselves, suspecting secret identities?
Parents have to say, let me take a second look at my child. They seem normal, but secretly, our own people are engaged in something that most of us don't know about.
It's a tough situation when a parent reports to the FBI about their own child, something we'd all have mixed feelings about. An internal holy war on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 11th. Todd Zwillick is here with me today. He's filling in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Celeste. Well, we have a look at the 5 Americans arrested today in Pakistan. Also, it's an anniversary. Bernie Madoff was arrested 1 year ago today. We'll talk to one of the victims, but let's get right to it. Everything you need to know this morning.
As we've been telling you, the 5 young American men who made their way to Pakistan were reportedly on their way to battle U.S. troops in Afghanistan. This Pakistani police officer was among those who arrested the D.C. area Americans.
They had U.S. passports, valid passports with valid Pakistani visas, and they were here for jihad.
They reportedly contacted militant groups via YouTube and other websites, but were rebuffed by the terror groups for being too Western. A drone attack in Western Pakistan has reportedly killed a top Al-Qaeda leader. Government officials are not identifying who that is yet, but reports are clear it's not bin Laden or his top lieutenant. We're joined earlier this morning by BBC correspondent Aleem Maqbool. Maqbool joined us from Islamabad for this story. I asked him if we're sure that a top Al-Qaeda official was actually killed.
No, and to be honest with you, we're not even sure whether there was, in fact, an airstrike, because that's what's being claimed, that an Al-Qaeda leader was killed in an American airstrike, a drone strike, one of these pilotless planes, in the tribal areas of Pakistan. Well, today we're being told by the Pakistani army that, in fact, there was no drone strike in the last 24 hours, so they're not sure where these reports are coming from. And we haven't been able to get any confirmation officially anywhere that this person has been killed. But it is a very difficult area to get to, these tribal areas. It is very difficult to verify if there have been strikes, airstrikes or not, and who's been killed in them, because it is very much a Taliban stronghold. There are military operations going there, and it is a very unsafe place to be for civilians and for reporters, of course.
Aleem Maqbool is a correspondent from our partner, the BBC. He joined us earlier this morning with details on the airstrike that has reportedly killed an unidentified Al-Qaeda leader.
The outbreak of the H1N1 or swine flu in this country is worse than we thought. Since April, there have been a rising number of swine flu-related deaths.
Sadly, nearly 10,000 deaths, including 1,100 among children and 7,500 among younger adults. That's much higher than in a usual flu season.
That's Thomas Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control. He had estimated only about 4,000 swine flu deaths several months ago. 50 million Americans, or one in every six, has caught the disease.
And European oil giant Shell has won the rights to develop an Iraqi oil field believed to hold almost 13 billion barrels of oil. Iraqi officials see the two-day auction as key to their country's post-war reconstruction efforts. Asian markets rallied. The Nikkei gained nearly 2.5%, and Wall Street futures are up. The Dow is going to open at 10,405. The S&P will start at 1,102, and the NASDAQ opens up at 2190.
Coming up, we talk movies every Friday and Clint Eastwood's new film Invictus. That's later on this hour. Now, President Obama comes back to the U.S. as a Nobel Prize winner today. What's going to change for him after his win? Nothing? Does it make things harder, easier? What's the task at hand? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, coming up, we follow the story of 5 Americans who went missing for a month from Northern Virginia until they turned up in Pakistan as alleged terror suspects. That's coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Five young Muslim Americans from the Washington, D.C. suburbs were arrested this week in Pakistan, and Pakistani officials say they are linked to al-Qaeda. We're joined now by Ibrahim Hooper. He's the National Communications Director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and Siobhan Gorman, Intelligent Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And I'm joined at the table, of course, by Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Siobhan, tell me first, we have no confirmation at this point that there's ties between these men and a terrorism plot, correct?
Well, there, I guess, are suspicions at this point that they were not a terrorism plot, but that they were seeking some sort of jihad training. And the stories are still a little bit confusing at this point, because American officials are definitely warning a lot more caution, and Pakistani officials are definitely getting quite out in front in terms of talking about internet communications with people who at least are linked to al-Qaeda, and it's not always clear what that means. But there does seem to be some strong suspicion that they were at least seeking to do some sort of jihad-type training in Pakistan.
And we have word from the Pakistani officials that they'll be deported back to the United States, but as of yet, there have been no charges filed.
Correct.
Siobhan, this is Todd Zwillick. You know, there's growing concern around Washington and a lot of other places about the next threat, homegrown terrorism. Are people going to jump to a conclusion that this is yet another case of homegrown jihadism?
Well, I think that we'll obviously have to see what sorts of charges get filed and things like that. If the details that are emerging now do seem to hold up, I think that people probably will point to this as another of the recent cases of young men in the United States, American citizens, becoming radicalized, perhaps through internet communications or, you know, other sorts of local interactions, and trying to, you know, go begin to take action on that somewhere overseas. So, yes, I mean, the interesting thing is that we've actually seen a number of these cases emerge, particularly this year, and I've talked with counterterrorism experts who are kind of puzzled as to why we're seeing so much of this year.
Ibrahim, I want you to listen to something that we heard from Imam Johari Abdul Malik from Northern Virginia.
This is really a moral low for our community. Parents have to say, let me take a second look at my child. They seem normal, but secretly, our own people are engaged in something that most of us don't know about. And that is sending a chill through our community.
Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American Islamic Relations, I just want to get your reaction to that. Is there a chill going through the Muslim community?
Well, I don't know that there's a chill, but there's obviously a concern when you get a case, and if it turns out to be the way it's being portrayed, because already some of the information coming out of Pakistan we know is inaccurate, just as the organization that was talking to the families, even things like, you know, names and all of these kinds of things have been portrayed inaccurately. So I would wait until they get back here, can be debriefed, and see what the real situation is. But it raises this case, and possibly others, raise enough concerns that it's something that the Muslim community wants to deal with. That's why we're planning an outreach campaign to Muslim youth, offering a mainstream perspective on a variety of issues, so that when they go on the internet and have access to these kinds of extremist viewpoints from overseas, you know, that they have a balancing perspective. Because I don't think we're seeing this kind of thing develop from something that's said in a mosque in America. You're seeing it develop from people accessing extremist websites or extremist viewpoints in the international arena.
Siobhan Gorman of Wall Street Journal, I want you to listen to this reaction from terrorism analyst Neil Livingston.
There were no radical influences within the household, but they fell under the spell of radical Islam, either online or through radical imams in their local mosque, things like that.
And you heard what Ibrahim Hooper said. Are these radical imams, maybe from overseas, are they actually recruiting Americans?
Well, we don't know that yet. What we're told, and again, this is from a few Pakistani officials at this point, and so everybody's trying to kind of doubly verify some of these things, is that they were in communication with people who were at least linked to Al-Qaeda operatives via the internet. So most of the indications are at this point that, if radicalization occurred, it may well have occurred because of internet communications with people overseas. There weren't a lot of indications that there were influences within the community in the U.S. that were pushing them in this direction. But again, we don't know enough yet to make strong conclusions one way or the other.
Ibrahim Hooper, your organization, the Council on American Islamic Relations, was actually involved in turning these five young men over to the FBI, or going to the FBI with the concerns of the parents. And I'm wondering what kind of concern is this? If there is, a seduction for young Muslims toward this radical viewpoint, is there a strong concern among the Muslim community in the United States that they won't have control over this, that this is something that could go on without them being able to step in?
Well, when the parents came to us, we didn't know exactly what was going on, and again, we still don't know exactly what was going on, but they had suspicions, they had concerns. All they knew at that point was that they believed their children had gone overseas. They didn't know why, they didn't know what motivated them, they didn't know anything. They came to us, and we put it together mainly with this video that was left behind, and said, look, we got to inform the authorities about this, and it's gone forward from there.
So, I mean, the takeaway for me is a question, really. How do we, as Americans, all Americans, Muslim or not, how do we guard against this? How do we watch for signs of extremism?
Again, I think it's the duty of any parent, whether you're Muslim, Christian, Jewish, whatever. You got to watch your kids. You got to be aware of what they're doing on the internet. I know that's difficult, but just interact with them. Make sure that their emotional and spiritual needs are being taken care of, so they're not feeling like they have to go to some internet extremist site to get some kind of fulfillment.
Ibrahim Hooper is the National Communications Director on the Council on American Islamic Relations. Siobhan Gorman is an intelligence correspondent with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to both of you, talking about the five young Muslim Americans who disappeared from the Washington, D.C. area and showed up in Pakistan. It's 15 minutes past the hour now. Let's take a look at the headlines.
A CIA official is denying a report that Blackwater security guards performed secret CIA missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our partner, the New York Times, says the firm's guards took part in raids against suspected militants. The CIA says the company only provided security. North Korea is talking about its first direct talks with the Obama administration. Following a visit this week by U.S. envoy Stephen Bosworth, the North Koreans say the two sides agreed on the need to restart stalled international talks on the nuclear issue. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she was pleased with the meeting.
I think that for a preliminary meeting, it was quite positive.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il did not attend. European Union leaders have been meeting in Brussels as the UN climate talks continue in Copenhagen. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says EU leaders have agreed to contribute more than $3 billion to a fund to help poor countries deal with climate change.
A final vote is expected in the House today on a sweeping overhaul of Wall Street regulations. The bill aims to address the conditions that led to last year's financial crisis. Finally, whoever cut down a 7-foot conifer in the Seattle Arboretum got a lot more than typical Christmas tree. It's a rare, endangered species from China that may be impossible to replace. It's also valued at more than $10,000. For the future, authorities say they're considering ways of preventing people from cutting down the trees. Obviously, those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, who wouldn't want billions of dollars? Well, banks don't. We'll talk about how banks want to hot potato TARP money straight back to the government. That's in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time for Takeout. That's a quick look at the stories we want you to be following this week. First up is Louise Story, finance reporter for New York Times.
Good morning.
And our Takeout pal. Hi, Louise. Goldman, you have a story in the paper this morning in the Times that Goldman's bosses, for some of their executives, are moving around with bonuses because there's an uproar over executive bonuses. tell me this isn't something that's Ponzi-like, that they're not just taking cash up front and moving it a few years down the line.
You fear an evil scheme here.
I'm dubious, but explain what they're doing at Goldman.
So what they're doing is the top 30 executives there will receive all of their bonus in stock, no cash. Typically, bonuses are paid partly in cash, partly in stock.
Right.
But let's be clear here. You can make a lot of money in stock.
In stock, right.
There's no limit on this could be, you know, $40 million in stock. I mean, they didn't put any limit on how much stock, but it will be all stock.
So here's my question. If Goldman is doing this because there is an uproar in the country over executive bonuses,
mm-hmm.
is there no discussion of not doing bonuses? Instead, they've just moved them later and they can still be $40 million.
So on Wall Street, there is a widely accepted view. This is within Wall Street. It's not certainly not average Americans. But on Wall Street, people believe that you've got to pay people for their hard work. And frankly, from their point of view, the last 2 years have been full of a lot of hard work. So Goldman's doing this.
Wait a second.
I'm telling you their view.
I'm just saying a bonus isn't necessarily paying someone for their hard work. Their salary is paying them
right.
for their hard
but,
work.
But, you know, Goldman has had a very profitable year, so they point to that. And what they are doing here is they're locking up the bonuses for 5 years. So that's
But if all that is true, why not just be honest about it, saying, you know what, they worked hard, we made a profit, we're paying back money, bonus.
They're doing that. But they're doing both, so they're trying to appease the people who fear short-term profits, but they're also trying to pay long-term bonus. But this is part of a much broader discussion.
Right.
And so we're going to see a lot of companies addressing this in the coming weeks. Today, we're going to see the compensation czar ruling on AIG and Citi.
Yeah, what's going on with Citi?
So Citigroup is one of the few companies that's still underneath this compensation czar appointed by the Treasury Department. Bank of America got out last week, and they repaid the bailout. So Citi executives last night, late into the night, were negotiating with regulators to try to repay the bailout money because they would like to get out from these extra compensation rules that companies like Goldman don't have. The problem for Citi is that they got more knee-deep in this bailout than any other bank.
Might have gone beyond the knees, actually.
Well, maybe be up to the hip.
Right.
But that's because they let the government convert part of the bailout into common stock. So not only do they need to transfer the money back in an account, but the government has actually got to go sell that one-third stake it has in Citi. So it's much more complicated, and it may take them a while to work it out.
All right, time is of the essence. Citigroup wants to get out from under the tarp so they can get those bonuses. All right, thanks, Louise.
Our next takeout is from Iran. Defense Secretary Robert Gates made a prediction today when he visited with the U.S. troops at an airbase in northern Iraq.
I think that you're going to see some significant additional sanctions imposed by the international community, assuming that the Iranians don't change course and agree to do the things that they signed up to do at the beginning of October.
Joining us now to talk about this is David Sanger, the New York Times chief Washington correspondent. David, President Obama did give the Iranians a deadline for improving the position on nuclear enrichment in their country. It looks like they may not make it. And is this the first time we've heard an Obama official say definitively that we will probably see more sanctions?
No, it isn't. You heard President Obama himself say a few weeks ago that he was now going to pursue two tracks. Track one was going to be continued diplomacy, including that apparently moribund deal to get some of Iran's uranium out of the country. And track two is the sanctions track. And you heard the president say it again in the Oslo speech yesterday, accepting the Nobel Prize, when he talked explicitly about the need for the world to come together on sanctions on Iran and countries like it.
So is this news from U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates? Are we hearing something that we have not heard before, maybe a sense of urgency?
I think that maybe as a public expression that there will almost certainly be sanctions in the next few months, it may have slightly moved the ball. But to those of us who've been, you know, listening to the administration on this and certainly talking to administration officials as they have been putting together possible sanction regimes that the Chinese and the Russians might be able to sign on to, no, I wouldn't say that it's news.
So as we get closer to the President Obama's deadline, what should we expect to hear from the administration?
Well, I think you're going to hear three things. The first is the need to retain some unity among the P5, that is the Europeans and Russia and others, on a sanctions regime. The second is the actual structure of that set of sanctions. And increasingly, you're hearing talk of going after companies that do business with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the most important political operation within, and of course military operation within Iran. And the third thing that I think you're going to be hearing more and more about is what are the options if sanctions fail? Because remember, three successive rings of sanctions that have been opposed by the UN Security Council have failed.
Right. David Sanger is the New York Times chief Washington correspondent. Thanks, David.
Now, as always, our last takeout comes from you. Yesterday, President Obama accepted his Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. A lot of you wrote and called in to say whether or not you think he deserves it. Not surprisingly, this was a pretty contentious issue. Here's a Bill in Port Washington, New York.
I believe the Nobel Peace Prize was given to the American people as much as it was given to Barack Obama for electing a African-American as president. This speaks volumes to the whole world, and certainly President Obama has broken huge barriers to bring peace and understanding to the world.
Today, President Obama is coming back to D.C. with his Nobel Peace Prize in hand. What do you think is going to change for him at home? Maybe nothing. Maybe it'll get harder, maybe easier. And what is his initial task at hand? What should be top of his priority list? Healthcare, maybe? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, you know, Todd, I think the first anniversary you give paper.
Right.
But for the victims of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme on the first anniversary of him being arrested, I think the only kind of paper they want is folds into your wallet. We're going to be talking about that in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. The five young Americans arrested in Pakistan this week were reportedly on their way to join up with Islamic militants to fight against U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The D.C. area men apparently tried to contact the groups through Facebook and YouTube. Earlier, we spoke to Ibrahim Hooper from the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He urged caution until more details are known.
I would wait until they get back here, can be debriefed, and see what the real situation is.
Pakistani officials say the five Americans are likely to be deported. Our partner, the New York Times, says private security guards working for Blackwater participated in covert CIA raids in Iraq and Afghanistan. The so-called snatch-and-grab raids reportedly happened regularly between 2004 and 2006, but the CIA denies the story. And European oil giant Shell has won the rights to develop an Iraqi oil field believed to hold almost 13 billion barrels. Iraqi officials see the two-day auction as the key to the country's post-war reconstruction efforts.
U.S. innovation slowed this year for the first time in 13 years. The number of patents filed fell more than 2%. Analysts say as the recession cut into budgets, the cost to protect innovations went up. And GE is throwing its money to the wind. The company secured a $1.4 billion contract to supply wind turbines that will be part of the world's largest wind farm. The 30 square mile farm in Northern California will supply power to over 200,000 homes. Time for a check on the markets. Asian markets rallied with the Nikkei gaining nearly 2.5%. European indices are also pushing higher. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow opens at 10,405. The S&P will get underway at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,190. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
1 year ago today, Bernie Madoff was arrested for masterminding a $50 billion Ponzi scheme that went back to the 1990s. He is currently in prison serving a life sentence, and his victims, his family, his former employees, are all still trying to piece their lives back together again. We're joined by Cynthia Crane. She was one of the Bernie Madoff's many victims, and she talked to us back in June as Madoff was being sentenced to life behind bars. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Well, today is quite a day, isn't it?
It certainly is, probably more so for you than for me.
Yeah.
Remind our listeners of how much you lost in the Ponzi scheme.
Well, there were five of us. You know, I have two daughters and a sister-in-law, my husband and me. And when you put it all together, it was in the millions.
And you actually wrote a play about this called John Denver, Bernie Madoff, and Me.
A cabaret show, right. It sounded like, you know, the guy who put the pea in Ponzi, the bull in bull market, and scum dog billionaire. Let's put on a show. So I did.
Well, it sounds like you're working through your emotional trauma over the event. But tell me a little bit more about the financial repercussions. We've been hearing a lot about auctions of Bernie Madoff's items. We've found out that the trustee has recovered $1.4 billion of the $65 billion that were lost. Have you seen any money coming back?
No, I don't think we're going to. I really don't.
How do you file for that? How do you have to fill out a form?
Oh, there's all sorts of class action suits going on and forms to go to the government. But they've changed the rules, and they're not. I thought insurance was insurance, but the SIPC is not going to cover us.
And we've also heard about an effort by victims to approach Congress and get Congress to step in and maybe help the victims see some of their money get back. Are you part of that effort?
I think we're part of the class action, yeah. But it's not only that. We would like to see things change so that this couldn't happen again.
The regulations.
Yeah, I mean, even Madoff himself said they came after him a few times, and each time he thought, oh, well, this is it, the jig is up. And no, they let him go, and he said, well, got away with that again. So I think the laws have to be changed.
Are you marking the anniversary in any special way?
Well, the show was my therapy. I've been working on it all summer and fall, and I've been doing it at a club called Don't Tell Mama with full houses, and it's terrific therapy, I must tell you.
What kind of reaction did you get from the audience? Is there?
Well, they're not quite sure. First of all, a lot of them don't realize that John Denver's estate was involved. And so they say, well, why John Denver, Bernie Madoff, and you? And so I explain it. And I found some funny songs. I don't want anyone to think I'm maudlin or beating my breast in public. I want everyone to forget
right.
the ramifications of the money and just laugh, and we do.
Well, I hope that you can laugh about it again next year's anniversary and after that. That's Cynthia Crane joining us from New York. She was a victim of the Madoff Ponzi scheme. And for a different view of the entire of this anniversary, we can go to Aaron Lucchetti. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning.
There are a separate set of victims of the Madoff scheme, and those were the people that worked for him, many of whom had no connection or I guess were not aware that something illegal was going on.
Yeah, it's a very interesting group of victims because a lot of them lost money, not as many, obviously, as from outside the firm, but many also lost their jobs. There were about 30 who kept their jobs at a new firm that succeeded Madoff's trading business, the legitimate part of the business called Surge Trading. But there are also about 150 to 200 that lost their jobs and had to find something else. And this wasn't just losing a job at any time. It was losing a job in one of the worst job markets in generations. And it was losing a job from a firm that was notorious and where everyone's first question when they saw your resume was, well, what did you know and what do you think the other people knew, and why didn't you know? How could you work there and not know there was such a bad thing going on?
You write about several people, and the stories are actually quite moving, who say they'll never again get a job in finance and are worried they're unemployable. You talk about Bernie Madoff's assistant, highly skilled assistant, who had to go to beauty school and to become a hairdresser.
Yeah, people have had to be resourceful and embark on second careers. At age 59, Eleanor Squillari, Bernie Madoff's old assistant, has gone to beauty school. She's moved into a smaller apartment, which she now rents in Staten Island. And she even wrote about the whole Bernie Madoff situation in her years at the firm and made a little bit of money that way. So it has caused people to be very resourceful and to think about what their lives could look like if everything stopped on a dime.
And what about his two sons? They actually turned him in for running what was the largest Ponzi scheme ever, and they not only have it on their resume, they have this Madoff name on their driver's licenses.
Exactly, and also have a lot to deal with in terms of legal issues, and their whole net worth is tied up in their father's firm. And even if they didn't know anything, they're likely to have to give up a lot of those assets. And so they really need the money going forward if the case proceeds, as many think it will, with Mark Madoff and Andy Madoff having to give back their houses, a lot of their assets, and having to start over at some point.
Have they been implicated in any way?
Well, it's been a year, and one interesting thing is that the sons, Andy and Mark Madoff and Bernie Madoff's brother, Peter Madoff, who people have been looking at from day one, have not really surfaced in any way as knowing about the fraud. They are under investigation, but it's nothing yet that's surfaced. And people who know mm-hmm. them say, and their defenders are pointing out that, you know, by this point something would have come out had they really known if there was a smoking gun that showed they were involved.
Aaron Luschetti is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal talking about the one-year anniversary of the arrest of Bernie Madoff. Well, coming up, we talk about movies as we do every Friday, and here's the trivia question for the day. Invictus is out this weekend, starring a very beefed-up Matt Damon. He plays a South African rugby player. What other movie does Matt Damon play rugby in? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. The thousands of government officials and climate change scientists and campaigners gathered in Copenhagen over the last couple of weeks are trying to find ways to cut global warming. But let's face it, everyone flew there in planes. Everyone has the lights on in their hotel rooms. They're all eating in restaurants. So the host Danish government has come up with a surprising way of making the summit carbon neutral, if they can, by putting their money into a project trying to cut emissions and pollution in one of the world's dirtiest cities, but it's thousands of miles away in Bangladesh. And the solution they've come up with sounds something like this. Now that's the motor of a brick kiln in Dhaka. That's the capital of Bangladesh. And the BBC's correspondent Mark Dummett is in Dhaka to explain it to us. Mark, hello.
Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. Mark, so what does a brick factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh have to do with a climate summit in Copenhagen, Denmark?
Well, the traditional brick factories, of which there are thousands surrounding Dhaka, which is this huge and growing city, these factories are incredibly polluting. They're basically using technology which hasn't changed in decades, if not hundreds of years. I mean, basically, it's clay which is burnt in a big oven using a whole load of coal. So what the Danish government is doing is they're investing in a project which is being organized by the World Bank to bring in technology from China, which is clean technology, or much cleaner technology. It's basically modernizing the whole process, but it is expensive to get these various things in, these various parts and motors and so forth in, which is why it requires this initial investment.
So, Mark, why Bangladesh? Is this the rich countries trying to show what they can do in the poorer countries and that we can all help climate change?
Well, I think there are two reasons. I mean, firstly, they would say that this is a project which will work. They will be able to dramatically cut carbon emissions from here and air pollution in Dhaka as well by replacing these old kilns with new ones. But secondly, Bangladesh is, of course, one of the countries which is being worst affected by climate change. I mean, the scientists say that if the sea levels continue to rise as they're doing so, and they rise by 1 meter, then by 2050, 20 million Bangladeshis living along the coast could lose their homes. So they're doing this project in this country at this time to show that Bangladesh will be supported.
Well, I want to give you a minute here, Mark. You've been to these brick kilns. You've seen them operate. Set the scene for us a little bit and describe the scene as people make bricks the old-fashioned way.
Well, it's incredibly dirty. I mean, they're centered around these huge chimneys with this horrific black smoke pouring out. So, as the Danish government says, any effort to try and change this, to modernize things, clean it up, will be welcomed massively by most Bangladeshis, most people in Dhaka.
All right, Mark Dummett, BBC correspondent, is in Dhaka in Bangladesh talking with us about the brick industry there and the Danish government's attempt to invest some money in cleaning up brick kilns in Denmark. Now, of course, the climate change conference going on in Copenhagen right now, and the Danes and Europe trying to show that everyone can get on board, not just the rich countries, but the poor countries too. Of course, it does make you wonder a little bit what pollutes more, a giant coal-fired power plant or 100 brick kilns in Bangladesh. You wonder where most of the carbon comes from. But I guess everybody has to get on board because Mark is right. When sea levels rise, it's countries like Bangladesh who feel the brunt first. It's not a coal-fired power plant in Iowa.
I'm
Todd Zwillick here with Celeste Headley. John Hockenberry is out this morning. As always, here's our trivia question for Friday. Invictus is out this weekend in limited release. It's starring a beefy Matt Damon, as Celeste said, who plays a South African rugby player. So here's the question. What other movie does Matt Damon play rugby in? Let us know, 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, here are some of the stories we're following this morning. The Centers for Disease Control says the number of deaths related to H1N1 or swine flu is much higher than originally thought.
There have been, we estimate, nearly 50 million cases, mostly in younger adults and children. More than 200,000 hospitalizations.
That was Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the CDC. He says there have been around 10,000 swine flu-related deaths since April of this year. The House is set to vote today on a big overhaul of the country's financial regulatory system. The legislation would create a new agency for consumer protection and increase oversight of financial institutions. Meanwhile, Goldman Sachs announced it would not be paying bonuses to its most senior executives this year. Instead, they will get long-term stock benefits. The move is part of Goldman's efforts to quash controversy over the enormous salaries and bonuses some of its employees are being paid.
And speaking of bonuses, employers are increasing holiday bonus payments this year in an effort to hold on to the best employees. A full 8% of employers surveyed in a recent poll said they plan to increase employee bonuses. And General Electric announced it's finalized a contract for the world's largest wind farm. GE will provide wind turbines and services for the wind farm in Oregon. When completed, the farm will produce enough energy to power nearly 235,000 California homes. This week, thousands of people are gathering in Copenhagen trying to find ways to cut global warming. Late yesterday, three U.S. senators offered up their own draft of a climate change and energy bill. To talk about that, we have John Broder. He's the New York Times environmental correspondent in Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste.
I assume that this proposal was timed to coincide with Copenhagen, so maybe the intended audience was the delegates there.
Well, absolutely. The Senate is really not engaged fully in this debate yet, but Senators Kerry Graham and Lieberman wanted to send a signal to the delegates in Copenhagen that the Senate would take this up seriously in the spring and that they, for one, were working on a plan that they hoped would pass.
What kind of proposal are we talking about? Are we talking about one of those vaguely worded rhetorical pieces of proposals, or is this a detailed, well-thought-out plan that could eventually end up someday as law?
No, it's more the former, a vague, detailed statement of principles. It builds on the legislation that Senators Kerry and Boxer managed to push through the Senate Environment Committee last fall, and on the House bill that passed in the spring. But what it really does is try to bring in a bunch of other senators, including some Republicans, by offering incentives for offshore drilling, for nuclear power, and even some breaks for the oil industry.
Okay. John Broder is the New York Times environmental correspondent in Washington. Thanks, John. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Friday is movie day for all of us, and especially on The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman, Takeaway film contributor and film critic for Newsday, is here to talk about one movie opening and wide release this weekend. That's Invictus, starring Matt Damon and Morgan Freeman. Of course, we want to mention quickly there's two other big movies coming out this weekend. Lovely Bones, directed by Peter Jackson, and I'm sorry, but Lord of the Rings fans hear Peter Jackson and they say, sold, I'm going to see it because Peter Jackson's involved. Also, you've got Single Man, Colin Firth's acting job in Single Man. He's starring as a gay man under emotional stress. A lot of Oscar buzz around that one. There's Oscar buzz all the time. I don't know how to interpret it, to be honest. But let's move on. We got to move on because we want to talk about Invictus. It's Matt Damon. It's Morgan Freeman. It's about South African rugby political inspiration of Nelson Mandela. Ray, it's directed by Clint Eastwood, and talk about Oscar buzz. Every single time Clint Eastwood puts his finger on a movie, the O-word gets mentioned.
That's right. It's funny because I think he's actually a fairly uneven director in a lot of ways. I mean, he's done some really amazing films. I mean, Unforgiven to me is pretty much his masterpiece, if not one of the great masterpieces in American movies. And yet he can also do these, what I think are some pretty bad films, like Bloodwork, which I thought was like one of the worst films of the decade, just a terrible, terrible thriller. And he can do really good sort of A-list Hollywood craftsman like movies like this one, Invictus, or a movie like Changeling or Million Dollar Baby, which I think are good top-notch Hollywood films. And that's pretty much the mode he's in, I think, with Invictus.
A top-notch Hollywood film suggests to me formulaic. I'm decoding you a little bit.
I think that's perfectly fair to say. I mean, this is a sports movie. I think we can probably guess the ending. There are certain things that I think you're going to expect out of the film that you're going to get.
Let me ask you quickly. I saw the trailer. It didn't have a whole lot of dialogue in it, but it did have a very brief clip of Matt Damon doing his South African accent. It's not an easy one to pull off. I'm a lover of accents. How does he do? Is it believable?
It's hard for me to say to my untrained ear, not having spent a lot of time there or knowing a lot of South Africans, and I'm guessing I'm probably like most Americans in that respect. I think one key with a film is if everyone is sort of on the same page accent-wise. That can help.
All right, speaking of accents, we want to listen quickly to Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela.
They are our fellow South Africans, our partners in a democracy, and they treasure Springbok rugby. If we take that away, we lose them.
Wow, that's a portrayal that's pretty dead on.
I mean, that's the thing about Morgan Freeman is, hasn't he kind of been playing Nelson Mandela in some way for most of his life?
Interesting takeaway like from Rafer Guzman.
This is just sort of the first time he's actually had the name on the character. And he's great. He's perfectly, you know, he's wonderful in it, and he pulls it off very well.
All right. Well, Invictus isn't just about Oscar buzz and parsing the accents of Matt Damon, because there's some controversy around this movie that we want to get to. And we're joined by Nadia Neofitu, arts and entertainment journalist for Eyewitness News at Prime Media Broadcasting in Johannesburg, South Africa. She joins us now. Nadia, there is some controversy in your country about this movie and some outcry because of the lack of South African actors that were chosen to portray South Africans in this movie.
Well, indeed. You know, it started with a call by the Creative Workers Union of South Africa, in fact, with another film that the announcement was made that was going to be made at the same time that Invictus was getting about to be released. So this film is about Winnie Madikizela Mandela, Nelson Mandela's previous wife. And the star for that one is going to be Jennifer Hudson. So, of course, coupled with that, and then we've got Morgan Freeman playing Mandela and Matt Damon playing Francois Pienaar, the Creative Workers Union were very upset with this and saying, you know, we want more South African actors, because we do have some great talent to take on the strong roles in these stories.
I wanted to ask you about that. Have they put forward actors that they think could rival Morgan Freeman or Jennifer Hudson on the screen?
Well, I think the criticism has come more for that, the Winnie film. People here are thrilled with Morgan Freeman's performance. And everyone says, you know, there's no one who could do a better job than him. I mean, he is literally the person you think of when you think of actors to play Mandela.
Like Rafer said, yeah.
He is the man, you know. So it's been more with the other film, but I think just because this is also released at the same sort of time, it's an issue that's brought to the fore now.
All right, Nadia, our partners at the BBC World News Update spoke with one of these actors. Her name is Florence Masabe. As she put it simply, listen to this clip from her interview.
South African actors are never going to be good enough because we don't have the Hollywood tag. We are tired of the Hollywood box office excuse.
So just the Hollywood tag and the box office excuse, does her opinion reflect other actors around your country?
It does, but at the same time, a lot of these actors have gotten an incredible opportunity to star alongside the big Hollywood names, which gives them a greater platform and way more exposure than they would ever have gotten.
Okay, Rafer Guzman is here talking about the film Invictus, our movie critic, and Nadia Neofitu joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa, arts and entertainment journalist for Eyewitness News at Prime Media Broadcasting in Johannesburg. Thank you both for joining us.
And Rafer, before you go, let me ask you this trivia question. We were asking our listeners and you, this movie obviously deals a lot with rugby. In what other movie does Matt Damon play rugby? 2006?
I embarrassed myself last time on the trivia question. You're saying this is a 2006 Matt Damon film?
He doesn't know.
I don't know.
We already have a winner, actually, from one of our listeners. Tim in New Canaan emails, "It was The Departed." Matt Damon plays rugby while he's at the police academy against the fire department.
That's two in a row for me.
Congratulations for Tim.
One more and you're not coming back.
Well, this isn't a trivia question, but it's still something we want you to answer. Obama returns to the United States with his Nobel Peace Prize in hand. What will change for the president, do you think? Nothing? Will things get a little bit harder? And what should his next task be now that his acceptance speech is over? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Also, we're going to find out who's won the Heisman Trophy in college football tomorrow. And at thetakeaway.org, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen gives you his prediction. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick, and for John Hockenberry. More than a year after the big banks nearly crumbled, Washington is trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. More regulation, more scrutiny, more limits on what Wall Street can do. Now the debate's in Congress between Republicans.
No more legislation that destroys jobs, and no more expansive, larger, and spending government.
And the Democrats.
Now, one of the odd things is, and I apologize to my colleagues, the bill's too big. I don't know whether that means it was too much to read or too heavy to carry. Or some really short ones can't see over it when they're sitting down.
But will all of this help you and your job avoid the next crisis? We're unwinding the latest attempt to rein in Wall Street, reading all the way down to page 800 and beyond on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 11th. I'm Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry. I'm here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Todd. We're going to check in first on our top news stories this morning. New numbers coming in the past half hour. The government says retail sales rose 1.3% last month. That's more than double the increase that economists had expected. Wall Street futures are on the rise as the markets look set to climb.
Five young American men arrested in Pakistan this week were reportedly on their way to battle U.S. troops in Afghanistan. They apparently contacted militant groups via YouTube and other websites, but once they arrived in Pakistan, they were rebuffed by terror groups for being too Western. Terrorism expert Neil Livingston says the young men all had parents who came to the U.S. in search of a better life.
There were no radical influences within the household, but they fell under the spell of radical Islam, either online or through radical imams in their local mosque, things like that.
Pakistani officials say the five Americans are likely to be deported. A final vote is expected today in the House on a sweeping overhaul of Wall Street regulations. It would create a new agency dedicated to consumer protection. It provides oversight of the derivatives market and gives the government more power to oversee and, in some cases, even shut down troubled firms before they can endanger the economy. For more on the story, we're joined now by Andrew Ross Sorkin. Andrew is chief acquisitions and mergers correspondent for our partners in New York Times. He's also the author of Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system. Andrew, the House is probably going to pass this sweeping regulation overhaul of Wall Street. The bottom line is this going to prevent the next crisis?
The good news is it's going to improve the situation so that hopefully we don't have another crisis. It's hard to argue, however, that it's going to prevent another crisis in that there are still a number of lingering outstanding issues related to derivatives, related to capital requirements, how much leverage can be in the system, and that doesn't address this. But the idea of another Lehman Brothers failing and a sort of cataclysmic cascade effect through the system will be prevented.
Okay, Andrew Ross Sorkin, stay with us. What you're describing suggests that there are going to be some loopholes after this bill passes. We're going to talk to you more about that in just a moment after some more top stories.
The outbreak of the H1N1 or swine flu in this country is worse than we thought. Since April, there have been a rising number of swine flu-related deaths.
Sadly, nearly 10,000 deaths, including 1,100 among children and 7,500 among younger adults. That's much higher than in a usual flu season.
CDC Director Thomas Frieden, he'd estimated last month there would only be about 4,000 swine flu deaths. 50 million Americans, or one in every six of us, has caught the disease. And European leaders say they'll commit more than $10 billion a year to help the world's poorer countries fight global warming. That's meant as short-term help for those countries. Time for a check on the markets. Wall Street futures are up. As I said, the Dow opens this hour at 10,405. The S&P begins at 1,102. And the NASDAQ starts out at 2,190.
Now, later on this hour, how green does your store need to be before you're actually green? From a local business to Walmart, we talk about green businesses no matter what their size. Meanwhile, President Obama comes back to the U.S. as a Nobel Prize winner today. What's going to change for him now that he's a winner? Nothing? Does it make it harder or easier? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here for John Hockenberry, and I'm across from Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Todd.
Well, Celeste, lawmakers in the House are expected to vote today on legislation that proposes huge regulatory changes to Wall Street. So we're back with Andrew Ross Sorkin, chief acquisitions and mergers correspondent for our partners, the New York Times. He covers the very institutions that are going to be affected by these regulations. He's also author of Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system. We're also joined by Andrew Beauvais. He's an analyst with Rockdale Securities in Florida, an expert on these big banks. Andrew, I want to start with you and a few quick questions about this planned regulation, some of the hard news here. What this bill does the most, there's Consumer Protection Agency, there's banning some of the credit default swaps, banning subprime mortgages that got us into so much trouble. What parts of this bill are the best? What is this really going to do to immunize the system?
Well, the most important part of this bill was something called resolution authority, which is this idea that we can now unwind a financial institution in an orderly way. So when you think of what happened to a Lehman Brothers or you think of what happened to an AIG, up until now there's been no ability to unwind a hedge fund or an investment bank or an insurance company in any meaningful way without that cascading through the system. So effectively you're able to put one of these firms that looks like it's starting to get into trouble into a conservatorship, in the same way they did with Fannie and Freddie, in the same way, frankly, that the FDIC does.
Now, just help me real quick with unwind. That basically means break up, sell off, and shut down, right?
Exactly. But by the way, you would only use this authority when things get bad. So this is not about breaking the firms up today. This is not they're too big to fail, let's break them up today. This is when they look like they're getting in trouble, instead of letting them file for bankruptcy, stepping in the same way that the FDIC does to take them over.
But to a certain extent, I mean, to talk about what's going to go into this financial regulation, we're still very early on. We have no idea what's actually going to end up.
Well, yes, we are. Let's put that out there. This is all very, very early days, and to see what we actually get in the end, what passes in the Senate, what actually gets signed by the president, there is a long way to go, and there's already a lot of pushback on Wall Street and elsewhere against a variety of things, including, by the way, something called the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which has been proposed by the Democrats to sensibly protect consumers when it comes to mortgages and credit cards and things like that. There's already pushback on that. That's an amendment that I think we'll hear about a lot today. There's issues around derivatives, what's going to go on a clearinghouse to add some transparency to the system, and what is still going to be allowed to stay off of it, which will remain opaque. So there's still lots of issues outstanding.
And there's plenty of controversy to come on the role of the Fed. This House bill is pretty lenient on the Fed, but the Senate, at least some in the Senate, really want to crack down on the authority of the Fed and transparency at the Fed. Richard Beauvais, you're an expert on these very banks that Congress is trying to rein in. Do you think this bill will work? Can Congress really do anything to tame the Wild West that was Wall Street, or do they just exploit the next loophole?
So this bill is very significant. It's going to change the nature of how the banking industry in the United States operates. It's attempting to solve the problems that showed up a year ago, which specifically would be that these banks had borrowed too much money in the short-term debt markets and therefore exposed themselves to runs. It's going to attempt to change the fact that their assets were too illiquid, in other words, that the banks did not have enough money invested in areas which could immediately be used to pay off runs.
Yeah,
it's attempting to deal with the fact that the banks had taken too much risk in the way they constructed their balance sheets. And, of course, it's attempting to come down on all aspects of fraud that may have showed up in the system. In the process of doing that, it will make the banking system in the United States far safer than it's been, we'll say, in a couple of decades. But at the same time, it will pretty much take the banks out of the mainstream of the financial industry in the overall global system, which means that it runs the risk of weakening the ability of the United States economy to grow, and it also runs the risk of shrinking our ability to compete, you know, around the world with financial giants that are being developed in Brazil, in India, in China, and elsewhere. So bottom line, it makes everything safer, but the unintended consequence is it will definitely hurt the economy and slow down the growth of the banking industry.
All right, it's the age-old conflict in this country, balancing regulation and restraint with the wild horse of capitalism. But I want to turn around to TARP right now, and I want to play you a clip from Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner on the Troubled Assets Relief Program.
This strategy requires a limited temporary extension of the authority provided by the Congress under the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. It would be irresponsible to do otherwise.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, what the Treasury Secretary is talking about is the renewal of TARP. They're going to let that program go for, I think, another 8 months or a year. This means that even though the banks are paying back their TARP money now, they're not out of the water yet?
Yes and no. So the great paradox of this decision is that some of the biggest banks that you've been hearing about, Bank of America returning $45 billion, Goldman Sachs early, J.P. Morgan early, giving that money back. There has been a lot of money we've gotten back, and that's all good news. The bad news is that we've created a two-tiered system, and many of the community banks, the smaller banks in our country, are still relying on that TARP money, won't be giving it back anytime soon, and frankly, some of them may need it still.
Richard Beauvais down in Florida, do we have a danger of a two-tiered system here?
Yeah, it's already been established. I think that, we're in a situation where the large banks in the United States have liquefied their balance sheets, have shifted their funding sources, and are able to operate again in a pretty normal fashion in the economy if the Congress doesn't stop them. There are another large number of banks that basically cannot do any of the above because they lack the appropriate funding, they lack the ability to get funding, and their balance sheets are locked with illiquid assets. Now, the issue, however, is does that matter? Because the four biggest banks in the United States have more than 50% of the assets of the American banking system, and those banks which have over $20 billion in assets, which would be the 30 biggest banks in the country, have 75% of the assets of the banking system, which means that there's 8,100 banks that have 24%. Those 8,100 banks, while very important to the people who operate with them or who do business with them, are not important to the U.S. economy.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, how are we doing on compensation? How are we doing on bonuses? We were talking earlier this morning about Goldman sort of backloading their bonuses in the form of stock. Of course, Citigroup is still under the bonus yoke because they're still taking TARP money and can't pay it back. What's the state of the bonus game now?
I think actually the biggest shift or biggest news was actually what we heard on Wednesday out of the UK, which was this decision to actually tax bonuses from 2009. And you're hearing that they're going to do that in France as well. The Goldman Sachs news was big in that everybody's just getting stock, no cash at all. However, you're still going to see big headline numbers. The numbers, the overall numbers, are not going to change. The good news is they're probably being more properly incentivized. The larger question is whether the public is willing to still accept those big numbers.
Is the public still willing to accept big $40 million bonuses? I'm speculating, but no matter how big the bonus is, or whether it's in stocks or in cash, bonus is still a bonus. That's Andrew Ross Sorkin, Chief Acquisitions and Mergers Correspondent for our partners, The New York Times. He's author of Too Big to Fail, The Inside Story of How Wall Street and Washington Fought to Save the Financial System. Richard Beauvais joins us from Florida. He's an analyst with Rockdale. We're talking about TARP and about Congress voting today on Wall Street regulations. And on Monday, we're speaking with Elizabeth Warren. She's the chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel that's overseeing the TARP bailout. So tune in on Monday. She will be with us. And look at some of the headlines at quarter past the hour.
Five Americans in custody in Pakistan for alleged terrorist activities may be heading back to the U.S. without being charged. That's according to a police chief in Pakistan. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in northern Iraq today. Secretary Gates hinted at significant additional sanctions on Iran if that country does not change course on its nuclear program. And here at home, the number of Americans estimated to have been killed by H1N1-related illnesses has been updated by the CDC. Health officials now say almost 10,000 people have died since April.
Coming up, players from Texas and Alabama vie for the Heisman Trophy tomorrow, and who will win? We'll talk sports in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some takeouts on news stories for this week. We are waiting for news on the Heisman Trophy. The award is going to be given out on Saturday.
Shotgun snap, McCoy scrambles left under pressure, throws it for the end zone. Cosby caught, touchdown Texas.
Mark Ingram now in the Wildcat formation is just going to take the direct snap and take off. Ingram touchdown. Sam throws, batted down, intercepted at Damakutsu. Sue to the 20, 15. Hawkins traps him, knocks him, touchdown Sue.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is out of town today, so to give us a rundown on early predictions, we have Pablo Torre. He's with us. He's a reporter with Sports Illustrated. Good morning, Pablo.
Good morning, guys.
We just heard some tape from three Heisman candidates. Are they our top runners, Colt McCoy, Mark Ingram, and Ndamukong Suh?
Yeah, and then you have another kid, actually a fourth, Toby Gerhardt out of Stanford. But those are the four. You got Ingram, McCoy, Suh, Gerhardt, with Tim Tebow as a fifth. He was invited also, but those four are really the top four candidates
okay.
we have going.
Bookend these for me. Who's most likely and who's least likely?
Yeah, the number one guy, it's really close race, all within about 14 points, according to the most reliable projections. Mark Ingram, the best player, arguably on the best team, is the favorite, with Toby Gerhardt out of Stanford, another running back, coming in second, followed by Ndamukong Suh, then Colt McCoy, then with distant fifth, you got Tim Tebow.
Can it just be Colt McCoy? Because the guy's name, he was born to be a football player. Come on, Colt McCoy.
Yeah, he needs to be a Western gunslinger, if not a
exactly.
Heisman Trophy winning quarterback, I think.
All right, so moving on from the Heisman, let's talk about Notre Dame, because they are getting a new head coach. Brian Kelly has agreed to a 5-year deal with Notre Dame, but he's leaving because of the rules. He's leaving his own team right before playoffs and moving to Notre Dame.
Yeah, it's been a chaotic week in college football. He agreed to a 5-year deal with Notre Dame. Coached the unranked in the preseason Cincinnati Bearcats to a 12-0 record. But yeah, he's leaving his team, and as you can understand, his players at Cincinnati aren't too happy about it. Marty Gilliard, the wide receiver, criticized him, felt betrayed. But, you know, this is a decision that's a no-brainer as far as the money goes. So you can't really blame the guy, I think.
Well, you could kind of blame him a little, I think.
You could kind of blame him.
Okay. Pablo Torre is a reporter with Sports Illustrated. Thanks so much.
Okay, our next takeout comes from Newsday film critic Rafer Guzman, who joins us to look at the big movies opening this weekend. We've got three of them. First is Invictus, Clint Eastwood's newest film, starring, of course, Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela, Matt Damon as a rugby star who Nelson Mandela tries to motivate to win the World Rugby Cup. What do you think of this film?
I think it's a pretty standard Hollywood sports drama. I think the acting is generally pretty good. Matt Damon gets a little sidelined. There's not a lot of Matt Damon in the film. It's mostly Nelson Mandela.
I like more Matt Damon in my films.
Yeah, I'm a big Matt Damon fan as well. But it's mostly Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela.
I have
doing
no problem
a lot of,
with that. I like more
sure.
Morgan Freeman.
And he's a great speaker. He's got that great voice, and he does it very well.
But you're suggesting a little bit formulaic. That's what I'm
detecting. It's a little bit formulaic. It's based on a true story, and I think that gives them not much leeway to play around with
the
characters.
Yeah, we know how this ends.
We do know how this ends. You can Google that pretty easily.
Exactly.
But there's not a lot of character interaction that's very emotionally engaging in the story.
Okay,
we want to move on to Lovely Bones, a new Peter Jackson film. Let's listen to this.
I was 14 years old when I was murdered.
You're the Salmon Girl, right?
On December 6th, 1973. I wasn't gone. I was alive in my own perfect world.
Rafer, Peter Jackson is directing this. I saw the trailer for this, and I was watching it saying, oh, interesting, and then they said, directed by Peter Jackson. And I went, seeing it, Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson, I'm going.
Yeah, you mentioned you're a Lord of the Rings fan. I think if you're a Heavenly Creatures fan, you're going to be a little more interested in this.
You know, this was a great book.
Yes.
But it was also, as a parent, a very disturbing book.
Yes.
How does he handle that balance?
For better or for worse, he glosses over it. You never quite find out what the villain, who is Stanley Tucci, who's great, by the way.
Who's always great.
You never quite find out what it is he has done to little Susie Salmon, which, you know, maybe for the best, and maybe you don't need to know. But there is, I in some way found that a little frustrating, actually, that I never quite knew the nitty-gritty of the crime.
All right, let's hit Colin Firth starring in A Single Man. Everybody says Single Man, then they say Oscar buzz. I'm always a little dubious about that because Oscar buzz is sort of put out there by the PR firm representing the film. Is it good enough for Oscar buzz?
I think there are still a few films left in the year that I have not seen, but so far I think this is the best film I've seen all year.
Best film you've seen all year?
I think so.
Wow.
All right, there's an endorsement. Go see A Single Man starring Colin Firth, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks for keeping us up to date on the movies.
Thanks for having me.
Our last takeout comes comes from you, and we still have a lively conversation going about Disney princesses. We talked about the new Princess and the Frog movie earlier this week. It's getting a lot of attention as the first Disney movie to feature a black princess, but it's not the color of the princess that has one family talking.
My name is Marcia Davis, and I'm calling from Florence, South Carolina. My granddaughter, she's 4 years old, she has a little problem with the princess. The reason why is because the princess is a frog most of the time. She said, Grandma, she said, why she got to be a frog? I said, well, baby, I don't know. I said, but we're going to go to the movie, and we're going to see if her being a frog is all right. Grandma, I don't like frogs.
Well, if a Disney heroine can't be a frog, then what can she be?
Hi, putting the princesses to the side and the question of whether or not they're good role models, I was, as a father of a five-year-old girl, very pleasantly surprised by the first Tinkerbell movie that was out on DVD, the main plot of which is essentially Tinkerbell coming to grips with her identity as an engineer, essentially. I was very happy to let my daughter watch that.
Tinkerbell is an engineer. The princess is a frog. If you want to weigh on at anything, you can let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking to you also about the president and what's next for him now that he's won the Nobel Peace Prize. Let us know.
Coming up, who ever thought that mashing together Jane Austen with zombies could possibly be a good idea? Well, the New York Times, that's who, and we talk about the magazine's big ideas issue in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some of the top news stories at 31 minutes past the hour. Now, we're just getting word. The Associated Press is reporting that Jenny Sanford, she's the wife of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, has announced she's filing for divorce.
Surprise.
This comes months after the governor's much-publicized affair with an Argentinian woman whom he called his soulmate in front of the press. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has made a prediction today about Iran as he visited with U.S. troops at an airbase in neighboring Iraq.
I think that you're going to see some significant additional sanctions imposed by the international community, assuming that the Iranians don't change course and agree to do the things that they signed up to do at the beginning of October.
Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent David Sanger gave us this assessment.
I think that maybe as a public expression that there will almost certainly be sanctions in the next few months. It may have slightly moved the ball.
Gates, though, downplayed the prospect of military action against Iran.
Americans are spending more at stores. A government report out last hour shows retail sales jumped 1.3% last month, nearly double what economists predicted. And the five young Americans arrested in Pakistan this week were reportedly on their way to join up with Islamic militants to fight against U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The D.C. area man apparently tried to contact the groups through Facebook and YouTube. Pakistani officials say the five Americans are likely to be deported. Taking a quick check on the markets. Markets are slightly up. The Dow's up 40, the NASDAQ up 11, and the S&P up 3. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Okay, so what makes a good idea? Of course, you have plenty of good ideas. You know you do. But what's the definition of a good idea? That's a question our partners over at the New York Times have been asking themselves and compiling this weekend's magazine. On Sunday, you can read their answers in the Time Magazine's 9th annual Year in Ideas issue, packed with some of the brightest ideas to be produced this year. Joining us with a preview of Sunday's feature is Chris Solentrop, staff editor at the New York Times Magazine. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Chris, you've edited lots of the ideas. You're here in the studio, and you're going to tell us about some of these. We're going to go over some of these bright ideas, but first, that sounds weird, the definition of a good idea. What is a good idea?
Well, to us, we're just looking for ideas from 2009, which means they were either discovered in 2009 or they manifested themselves this year in some interesting way. And to us, it's just the most, not necessarily the most
important.
I had
lots of ideas in 2009. They weren't all good, I can tell you that.
You know, and maybe these aren't all good, but they're interesting. They're not even necessarily the most important. Just interesting, clever, funny, silly, weird, and some are important.
All right, well, let's see if this fits in. We want to play a little bit of sound here of one of the good ideas from the New York Times Ideas 2009 issue. All right, now that is the sound of an American gas guzzler. It sounds
that needs a tune-up. Is
spewing out soot and carbon emissions. Why does that sound represent a good idea?
Well, the government did a study and found that hybrid cars are so quiet that they are more likely to hit pedestrians and bicyclists. And so, manufacturers are now starting to put fake car noise into the hybrid and electric cars so that people can hear them when they're coming around the corner.
See, now, I've always thought that you could do like a ringtone kind of thing. You know how you can customize your ringtones? They should have a downloadable ringtone application for hybrid cars. You could choose, you know, which sound you wanted your car to make. Now, we have a hybrid in the family, and as soon as I can download it, this is the one I want. Jetsons. What do you think?
That would be terrific. And the advantage then is you would also get the status of having a hybrid because your car would not make the noise you'd heard earlier, but
right.
a futuristic high-tech noise.
Futuristic Jetsons-like noise.
Exactly.
I mean, I could think of lots of noises I'd like my car. Maybe galloping hooves on the way. on the way around
that
the parking lot.
That would be fantastic.
All right. I want to listen to another piece of sound now for the next bright idea that the New York Times has identified. All right, the music that can bore into your brain if you let it. That's from the classic Game Boy game Tetris. It's about 20 years old, that game. It's not new, but what's the bright idea around this?
A group of researchers studied whether playing Tetris could help possibly prevent post-traumatic stress disorder. So they played a really horrific video to a group of people that had drownings and a car accident and horrific imagery, the kind that would cause flashbacks. And then a group of people sat around and did nothing after it. And another group of people, after a 40-minute pause, played Tetris. And the group that played Tetris experienced significantly fewer flashbacks over the next week than the non-Tetris group. So the idea is, and they're not totally sold on it, but they're investigating the idea of Tetris as a preventive treatment, playing Tetris as a preventive treatment
or
for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Maybe it is. Now, we don't know if this is specific to Tetris and the dynamics of the game or if it's just any Game Boy or any handheld video game.
That's true, though the study did involve Tetris, and it's heavily visual, and it presumably affects how the flashbacks are encoded on the visual memory of the brain.
All right, now we promised people before some zombies, and I don't want to disappoint them, so give this a listen.
The more I see of the world, the more I am dissatisfied with it, and every zombie confirms my belief that God has abandoned us as punishment for the evils of people such as Miss Bingley.
All right, not zombies per se, but a wonderful British accent describing them. Why is mashing up zombies with Jane Austen a good idea?
The surprise bestseller of the year is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which is a book that is about 85% Jane Austen and about 15% zombies.
That's just the ratio, 85-15.
That's my understanding.
It's a great book. It's really entertaining.
And just, you know, you take a book that's in the public domain, you add a sprinkling of zombies in zombie-appropriate locations, and you've got a new intellectual property that you can sell.
Okay, so that's lots of fun. Some of these ideas are in the far more serious realm. You guys identify social networks as foreign policy. Earlier this year, I guess in the spring, with the Green Revolution, the Iranian uprising against the government in Iran, Twitter, YouTube, social networking played such an important role, and you guys have identified that.
Yes. I mean, the interesting thing here is that the State Department, our government, has decided that social networks are just an inherent good, that unlike, say, Radio Free Europe, where you would broadcast actual information about freedom and liberty to communist countries, just the mere existence of person-to-person technological communication in tyrannical countries can promote freedom. This is the operating principle of the State Department.
State Department latching onto social networking. Well, we want to get to as many of these as possible because they're fascinating. Now, Celeste, you've got a young son. How often, I don't know if there's a number for this, how often does he smile? Does he smile a lot?
Pretty much all the time.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, you are in luck, and so is your son, Grant. You've got a study here on predictive smiling?
Yes. Researchers took college yearbook smiles and also smiles from people as young as 10, and the people who were the brightest, most intense smilers were something like 5 times less likely to divorce than the people who smiled the least in their photos. Oh, and these are candid photos, posed photos, a whole group of them.
And they did gradations of smile width. How do you do
this?
Yes,
people, they had people code the intensity of the smile having to do with their eye movements, muscle movements. So there are, I mean, there's some subjective, I suppose, coding, but there's, you know, it's...
Was there any research on the little boys that make zombie faces? Because I get that, too.
Maybe that's for 2010.
All right, Chris Solentrop, staff editor of the New York Times Magazine. They've got a feature this Sunday on the best, brightest ideas of 2009. Sounds of hybrid cars that are too silent, Jane Austen and zombies, and social networking in Iran. Thanks, Chris. I'm voting for the sounds and hybrid cars. I think you can can do, like we said, you can do Jetsons, galloping hooves. Boy, there's lots and lots of. How about the sound of, I don't know, rolling dice hitting the end of the craps table as you go. Chips flickering on the poker table would be great for your car. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Disturbing news from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They say that the death toll from the H1N1 virus has jumped to more than 10,000 since April. And they'd earlier estimated that only about 4,000 people had died. We're joined again by our friend, Dr. Richard Wenzel. He's an infectious disease specialist at Virginia Commonwealth University and immediate past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Wenzel, first of all, good morning. How did we make this mistake? How did we miss 6,000 deaths?
Well, according to CDC, a lot of that just occurred recently. It may be a combination of that plus sort of a new reassessment on their part as to how many more people got infected and died.
And this, I mean, 10,000 people clearly is a disturbing number. What has made the H1N1 so fatal?
Well, I think what's really different is that that most of the deaths, 8,600 of the 10,000, are in young people and children. This is unusual. Most of the deaths we see from seasonal flu, 90% are in seniors greater than 65. So that's what's new. Young people are getting infected. Young people are dying.
And we're not talking about infants. We're talking about school-age kids.
Well, we're talking about, school-age and young adults particularly.
And what can we do at this point now that we have this very disturbing number? I assume that people are reevaluating their strategies for combating this disease.
Well, I hope people will continue to get in line for the vaccine. That's always the baseline we have for infection control. Thereafter, the usual things about avoiding people who are ill. If you are ill, stay home. Wash your hands a lot.
There's a big one. I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's a big one. We just got a big, very dire notice from the head honchos at the station here saying, if you have flu symptoms, don't come into work. But people aren't taking that seriously.
They're not taking it seriously, and I think we have to recognize the economic pressures today, particularly people worried about keeping their jobs. I'm sure young people are worried about getting their children into daycare so they can continue to work. And college students who want to succeed are worried about staying away from classes. So these are real social pressures in contrast to the biology of the disease.
Okay, so Dr. Richard Wenzel, this is your platform. Can speak personally to the bosses out there about their employees. What do you have to say to them?
I would say, go ahead, please let people stay home. You will be healthier. You will be more productive in the long run.
One last thing, Richard. They have said that everyone can get the immunization now, right? That's widely available?
It's, well, at least almost 90 million doses should be available now. So it's still increasingly available. I still hear stories where people can't get it, but it should be available almost everywhere.
Okay, great. Dr. Richard Wenzel is the infectious disease specialist at the Virginia Commonwealth University. Good friend at The Takeaway. He's also immediate past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases. More than 10,000 deaths.
Stunning, 10,000.
From H1N1 since April. Yeah. So again, we want to reemphasize, if you are sick, stay home and go get the vaccine if you possibly can.
And wash those hands. Wash those
wash
hands.
Your hands.
So simple. It sounds
cough
dumb.
Into the crook of your arm.
So simple, so
yeah,
simple, and
simple
cheap.
We're going to be talking about green businesses in just a moment. Any size of green business. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is away today. And one of our producers, Leo, has written a nursery rhyme about an upcoming story. Here it is. Walmart, Walmart, environmental upstart, how is your business green? And my question to you listeners is, should we allow Leo to write any more nursery rhymes?
That was my question.
8778 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Starting with some positive economic news just out this hour. Retail sales are up more than expected in November as autos and gasoline post gains. The increase in sales is 1.6%. South Carolina's First Lady, Jenny Sanford, has just announced that she's filing for divorce from Governor Mark Sanford, according to the AP. The governor escaped impeachment by South Carolina lawmakers this week. And the CDC has revised the number of Americans stricken by the H1N1 virus or swine flu. Here's the CDC director, Dr. Thomas Frieden.
Sadly, nearly 10,000 deaths, including 1,100 among children and 7,500 among younger adults. That's much higher than in a usual flu season.
Last month, Dr. Frieden had estimated only about 4,000 swine flu deaths. One in every six Americans has caught the virus.
President Barack Obama is on his way back to Washington from Norway with his Nobel Peace Prize in hand. He'll return as the Senate continues work on an overhaul of the nation's health care system, his top domestic priority. Overseas, five young Muslim Americans detained in Pakistan for alleged terrorist links may be facing deportation. Siobhan Gorman is covering the story for the Wall Street Journal. Speaking on The Takeaway this morning, she said this may be another case of young American men in the U.S. becoming radicalized and trying to take action somewhere overseas.
The interesting thing is that we've actually seen a number of these cases emerge, particularly this year, and I've talked with counterterrorism experts who are kind of puzzled as to why we're seeing so much of this year.
There are no charges against the men, who are all from the Washington, D.C. area. Staying in Asia, North Korea is talking about its first direct talks with the Obama administration. Following a visit this week by U.S. envoy Stephen Bosworth, the North Koreans say the two sides agreed on the need to restart stalled international talks on the nuclear issue. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she was pleased with the meeting.
I think that for a preliminary meeting, it was quite positive.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il did not attend those talks. And finally, a large iceberg 12 miles long and 5 miles wide is on the loose, and it's heading for Australia. The iceberg sheared off of Antarctica and about a decade ago and is edging closer to Australia. Ships have been warned to take care, but the iceberg is expected to break up when it hits warmer waters. It's like a meteor almost entering the atmosphere.
Back, and it's mad.
I wonder how deep it is under the surface. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Energy efficiency.
More than just getting you to change a light bulb.
Climate change.
Renewable energy.
This is what the U.S. has committed. This is what the EU has committed for 2020.
What can I do about it?
This week, the Copenhagen Climate Summit is considering what can be done internationally, the macro environmental picture, what can be done to address climate change all across the world. But climate change, when we're coming down to changes in habits, really starts on a micro level. And we're joined today by someone who can talk about that specifically. Sean Meenan is the owner and designer of the Habana Outpost. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
And someone else with a slightly larger business, Candace Taylor, is the director of sustainability for Walmart.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Good. Sean, you have tried to go more green with your business. And can you tell me, first of all, what are some of the changes you've made in your restaurant?
I had a restaurant already, and this was kind of the next restaurant that I was doing. So I was trying to find ways to make it exciting for me, first of all. So it was a selfish thing in the beginning. Just I wanted to do something to kind of amp me up for my business. So I put a 40-foot array of solar panels in, and this was a number of years ago before things were really happening. And because it's an outdoor spot, you see the solar panels out there, and everybody walking by on the street, it's a very busy street, can see what's going on. And it was just a beacon for other environmentalists to come on and say, and the environmental movement is very generous in their information and their resources, and they're like, Sean, do you want to try this? Do you want to try that? And I was like, bet. And it just kind of snowballed and became a bigger thing. So there's a number of things we're doing. We're the first solar-powered restaurant in New York. We harvest rainwater to flush the toilets. We have some things that are fun as well, like we have a bike blender. You sit on it, and we give you $1 off if you pedal it yourself. And
really?
You pedal
to make your own smoothie?
To make your own smoothie.
Good for everybody.
And your car
sure.
runs on the restaurant's leftover cooking oil.
Exactly. It's waste product, and it takes a lot of money. It doesn't cost a lot of money, but it takes money in order to get it removed. And now I just put it in the back of my car. I have a 1965 Lincoln Continental convertible. I get 30 miles to the gallon running on French fry oil.
Has this cost you money or saved you money?
Well, I would say both. There's no doubt that retrofitting a 1965 Lincoln to run on French fry oil isn't cheap. I mean, it cost me a couple of dollars. Putting in the solar panels costs money. But in the long run, I mean, one, you can do it just in an environmental sense, like for the earth. But then as far as how you feel about yourself coming to work, and then as well the people who work there, they feel special because there are some environmentalists working there. If they have an idea, we want to try it. So that makes them feel good about working there. Then the people who come in feel good that they're supporting a spot that's doing something a little bit different. So some of those things are hard to tell you on hard numbers what the value is on that. But to me, there's no question that it's worth it.
Okay. Candace Taylor, you are the director of sustainability for Walmart. I would bet that you have some hard numbers for you, what you are doing at Walmart. Can you explain, one of the things that you've done is in terms of green buildings.
Yes. We have over 4,000 stores and clubs across the U.S., and we introduce LED freezer cases. So all of the lights in our freezer cases are made from LEDs. Mm-hmm. They use about 50% less energy than fluorescent lights.
That definitely saves you money, right?
We also have the plastic baseboards in our stores are manufactured from 100% recycled plastic. And an important note on that plastic is made mostly from pre-consumer unused diaper scraps.
Oh, that's interesting. Are they more expensive or less expensive than the regular?
The baseboards are at cost than the regular, and that saves tons of diaper scraps from going into landfill.
Okay. So, I mean, in the end, when Walmart is making these sustainability decisions, does cost end up being the bottom line? Does this have to be something that either zeroes out on Walmart's ledger sheet or something that saves the company money in the long run?
We pilot a lot of initiatives, and there are several factors: reducing waste, lowering costs, driving efficiency, and helping customers. So it's kind of like our mission is to save people money so they can live better. So when you have those two together, that's really what we're looking for all of our initiatives.
Sean, you heard that her criteria for her green initiatives, were those your criteria as well?
I would say Walmart and I are kind of working on a different paradigm as far as things go. Very much so, and I appreciate what Candace is saying. And I think as far as wanting to make things better for her customers, that's something that we very much take to heart. And because we're not on such a global grand scale, we can be a little bit more responsive to exactly what's happening with the people who are coming in. And like I said, I have people who are working there. They have a good idea. A lot of young people work there. I'm like, bet, let's try that. Let's try this. And I think the response rate is probably a little bit quicker with what we're doing there. And I think probably our bottom line is thought of in a different way, possibly, than what Walmart is thinking for their bottom line.
Okay, and Candace, there's an additional thing that with Walmart, we're also talking about you get a lot of products from China, and then so your sustainability and the greenness of Walmart is also affected by where you purchase the products that you sell.
Yes, one of the great products we have in our stores is concentrated liquid detergent, and our first 3 year savings on that has been 80 million pounds of plastic, 30 million gallons of water, and 125 million pounds of cardboard have been saved. We've saved customers enough water to save the equivalency, 100 million showers around the world.
Okay, but so, can we expect Walmart at some point to help put pressure on other developing countries to be more green?
We are working with our suppliers around the world, and we announced this past July that we're creating the Sustainability Index so that we can contribute and share with customers the sustainability attributes of every product we sell in our stores.
Candace Taylor is the Director of Sustainability for Walmart. She joined us from Bentonville, Arkansas. And Sean Meenan is the owner and designer of Habana Outpost. Thanks to both of you for joining us. So, Todd, one thing our listeners are really good about is being our own reporters in their neighborhoods. So we're asking you, the listeners, what have you seen when it comes to businesses near you being green? Something creative, something exciting, solar panels, a bike that makes your own smoothies? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Now, we also want to hear from you about the president. He came back from the U.S. as a Nobel Prize laureate winner today from Norway. What's that going to do to change him at home? Is it going to make things harder on healthcare or do absolutely nothing? Elizabeth emails us, nothing changes, and how Obama, he won the prize. It's a farce. He didn't do anything to win the prize, so nothing will change. What a joke.
But Greg emails, this administration will not change its approach to international affairs just because it received this prize. The president returns home to a rising unemployment rate and a recession that will not go away. He must decide whether to spend our tax dollars on an endless war or the very real needs we have at home.
Steve emails, for all you Harry Potter nerds out there, stay with me here. The Nobel Prize was in reality a portkey which transports our president to a place that needs the most peacemaking. That's Washington.
That's arcane fact there. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.